Thanks for listening to On Security, conversations with the world's leading security experts, part of the On Podcast Network. For more information, visit us at informit.com/podcasts.
Hi, this is Ben Roski. I'm a New York City-based senior security consultant with BT Global Services. Been in the information security space a little over 15 years. I'm a frequent speaker at conferences, write articles, and about 2 years ago came out with the book Computer Security, 20 Things Every Employee Should Know. On today's podcast, we have David Rice. David is a director with the Monterey Group, but likely known to more people via his book that came out this year, Geekonomics, The Real Cost of Insecure Software, published by Addison Wesley. I enjoyed the book immensely because David is, preaching the same message I've been doing for many, many years in the information security space. It's a very practical message, and it's more about really the dangers of insecure software. These are not just about, defaced websites. These are about, planes that are falling from the ground, mobile phones that are being hacked, cars that being recalled. So, it's not our mother's, software anymore. So it's a pleasure to have David on this podcast, and we welcome him, and we've got some great questions to post to you, David.
Great. I'm looking forward to it, Ben.
Okay. Let's talk at, a high level. So, I know what Geekonomics is about. So, what is this thing called, Geekonomics for our listeners out there?
Sure. Geekonomics is a way of looking at what has traditionally been a technology-centric view of the world and breaking it out a little bit more into the human-centric view of the world. That is, software is a tool that humans use, and it confers an enormous amount of advantage. But at the same time, humans are creating it, humans are consuming it, and it's easy to get technology-focused. But really what the book is focusing on is seeing, well, what is the bigger story of software in the human context, and how do the humans play into some of the benefits and, of course, some of the problems that we see in insecure software in particular. So really, Geekonomics is focusing at the highest level on public policy. And that primarily is that users have an immense lack of consumer protection when it comes to the software market. Software is perhaps one of the fewest products, or software has one of the highest level of defects of any product in the market. And yet the manufacturers have really no accountability for these defects. And so Geekonomics tries to look at the economic impact of insecure software, why we don't really apply the same public policy principles to software that we do to other technologies, and basically tell a good story. It's to illuminate why software is the way it is and why we tolerate the way it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. You talk about, end users and protection. I mean, one of the analogies you use throughout the book extensively is, calling users crash test dummies for software manufacturers. How'd that come about, and, what's going on, with users being, being these testers, for, which often should be beta software, but, nonetheless is shipping.
Sure. So the crash test dummies analogy is I see it as a very powerful analogy, because when we look at current product liability as we understand it today, it really didn't come into fruition until about the 1960s. And that was after years and years and years of extensive tort battles, of extensive, legal battles between auto manufacturers and the consumers themselves. So when we look at crash test dummy analogy, what we're really saying is that we understand that products are going to have some faults when they go into the global stream of commerce. We understand that. Sometimes, toasters just go crazy, or they electrocute you or something. But in the case of product liability, what they're really saying is, okay, vendors, you have to do much more than you did in the past in order to protect the consumer. So while product defects may be inevitable, What product liability laws or even regulation does is say, okay, we understand it's inevitable, but we're going to tolerate less of it than we do now. And that really is what it's about. It's giving the consumer or giving the population the ability to project their power back into the marketplace and say, hey, you know, this stuff is intolerable. And in software, there's a distinct lack of that. In fact, we've gotten so used to the patch and release cycle of software that we really are in a constant state of beta. Even when software goes gold, when we have a product come out in the space and it doesn't bear the title beta, it really is a beta. It's just a beta for the next product to come out. But what they've said basically is, okay, the rest of the testing as a software manufacturer, it doesn't make sense for me to do it. I'm going to offset the cost of testing and push it into the population so they can test it more thoroughly than I could. And that makes sense to a certain extent, except when you start seeing the effect of that. And the effect is we've all become, I think, very numb to the feeling of what even good software might look like. So we accept, oh, we've got another patch we need to apply, or you know, there's another upgrade coming. So we're always looking to the next thing to come out to replace the thing that we thought was good, but turned out to be not so good. So we're waiting for that upgrade, or we're waiting for the next release of that product in order to fix all the problems that weren't caught by the manufacturer beforehand. So when we start looking at crash test dummies, when we look at that analogy a little bit more closely, what we're really saying is that crash test dummies, as we know them today in the auto manufacturing realm, are surrogates for us. They are surrogates. They represent us, but they're not us, but they act like us when they're in an accident so that the manufacturer can tease out these design defects more thoroughly before we, the humans, have to feel them. In software, there is no notion of a crash test dummy. There is no surrogate for you. You are the crash test dummy. That is not just you, but your identity, your family members' identities, your business, your government, everything that software is injected to ultimately touches you in some way. And therefore, any mistake or any defect in that software means the impact is directly felt by you. And so therefore, you are a crash test dummy. And the argument in the book is that that is unacceptable. You know, we either need a surrogate that takes our place in the software world, or software manufacturers have to come up with a surrogate or come up with some means of reducing the impact directly felt by the consumer.
Wow. You know, it's not a pretty situation, sort of by way of analogy. In the movie Network, one of the stars, you know, became a classic line in cinema. He yells out, you know, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. And he uses that to persuade the Americans, the listening people, to shut up their windows, you know, that impassioned phrase. So, you know, obviously users are, you know, mad as heck about these bugs. So, you know, what can be done to change this situation?
Well, I think in terms of addressing the situation, that there's it's a multivalent approach. That just means there's lots of different things that need to get done in order to change the situation. There's a classic analogy between cars and software, and I'm going to fall back to that again because it does illuminate some very important things. And really what we look at is when cars were introduced into the marketplace, there were really only 4 pages of any type of legislation or any type of law that applied to vehicles. In fact, most of the laws applied to horse and buggies. And so the courts, as well as the legislatures, had to apply this very limited set of laws for horse and buggies and try to extend it to apply to automobiles. And of course, you have this problem of, well, not all the laws apply to a vehicle. A vehicle is a completely different creature. But if you also look at a vehicle, it's immensely more complex than a horse and buggy. And therefore, of course, you would have to assume to a certain extent that the laws would also have to be a little bit more sophisticated in order to handle a context that the vehicle imposes or interjects into the environment. Well, if you look at software compared to an automobile, software is infinitely more complex than an automobile. So when we look at automotive law, it really progressed over the course of 40 to 60 years to 4 pages into literally like 18 volumes of either civil actions or laws or legislation or some type of precedent that was set by the courts. So that was 50 years, and that's just for an automobile. When we look at software, well, we've got an immensely complex thing. And that means our response to it is also going to have to be far more sophisticated. Just as horse and buggy laws weren't sophisticated enough to deal with automobiles, my argument would be that automobile laws aren't nearly as sophisticated, or at least current product liability laws aren't sophisticated enough as is to handle the complexity or the complex nature of software itself. So saying that legal action would be enough, or legislation would be enough, or regulation would be enough, would be wholly incomplete. When we look at software, we have to look at it in bits and pieces, but we can't forget the whole that we're addressing in terms of software and how it touches our lives. So there's lots of different ways of looking at it, but it's going to require multiple vectors or multiple avenues in order to address this. And what are some of those avenues? Well, some of those avenues are, in fact, potentially liability laws or change in liability laws. There are certainly legislation that could come about. There are certainly some form of regulation that could be interjected into the marketplace to change the status quo. There could be consumer retaliation, that is, consumers unite and finally realize, well, hey, this thing is really affecting me, and now I'm getting pretty mad. I mean, my banking rates are going up, my identities are getting stolen. Whatever it happens to be, there's a certain pain threshold that individuals have themselves, but across the entire spectrum of consumers may not be equally valued. That is, for some person's threshold, it's very low. For some people's threshold, it's very high. So consumer retaliation is, and what I mean by that is that they choose not to buy a certain product because it doesn't do for them what they want or imposes too much of a cost because it's so insecure. They could act also. And so each one of these, when we start looking at the automobile industry, each one of these had to be pursued independently by different groups. And so it would be wonderful if we could say there is a cohesive strategy on the part of the United States to enact an automobile regulatory model that worked, but really it got started in fits and spurts until we have a very stable model today that we look to protect our families and our vehicles, to stipulate what the roadways are, how they're going to be laid out, what the sight lines of distance are, you know, whether or not they've got bot dots or whether they've got jersey walls. We have a very stable environment, but that took literally decades in order to create. When we look at the software space, it's a bouillabaisse of chaos. I mean, we have some network standards, but those network standards themselves are incomplete, or at least they're not, you know, really robust enough to handle enterprise class commerce models that we're trying to jam down it. Now, is the internet infinitely scalable? Absolutely. Is it a beautiful thing? Absolutely. But again, when we look at the chaos, the disorder, well, maybe chaos is too judgmental, the disorder that we see in the cyberspace realm, that really is the lack of oversight that we've injected into the software market in particular, but also into the networking market. So we've got a lot of different avenues to pursue. And of course, you know, we can talk about those as we progress through our conversation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those are all good points. Yes, you know, the show me the money issue is like, mm-hmm. How much do you have any type of figures or metrics? You know, I mean, how much does bad software cost the average American every year, both in a dollars per person, and also, you know, issues of, you know, lives lost due to, I mean, maybe you want to talk about in 1996, there was a software defect that around 757, maybe you could expand on that.
Certainly. So, you know, this touches on what the cost of insecure software is into our lives. And I really kind of mix in low quality software, and some critics may not think that's fair, but really there's a relationship between low quality and insecure software that we can tease out a little bit later. But right now I'm just going to jumble that all together for now. So basically what we're saying is that low quality or insecure software imposes a cost on us. And what in fact is that cost? Well, there's lots of numbers out there, and unfortunately, none of them make a whole lot of sense. Now, that doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that we don't have a lot of good data sources or reliable data sources to pull out of the marketplace to say it absolutely costs this. Now, I made a guess, and my guess was about $180 billion per year. And of course, people are right to take issue with that because we really don't have good numbers. And really what that number is meant to illuminate is the fact that, yeah, the number is off, but the criminal thing about it is we don't know by how much. And that's really the problematic issue that we have when we start talking about the cost or the real cost of software. Now, there's a cost of software, certainly, but there's a real cost also. And the real cost is really what you give up in order to get something. So it may be a dollar amount, but it may be something that you really can't put a quantifiable dollar amount to. Like, how much would you quantify national or economic security? Well, gee, that's a tough number to come up with, but that is potentially one of the real costs of insecure software. We have hostile nation states compromising our networks. We have hostile competitors taking intellectual property out of our networks. Heck, we have nation states taking intellectual property out of our networks and then giving them to their own national companies. So there's a certain cost that comes with it. It may be quantifiable, and it may not. But what we do know is that it imposes a difficulty or a harm upon us. And it really is up to us to figure out, well, is that harm tolerable? If you go back to the automobile analogy, the United States loses you have about 40,000 fatalities per year on the U.S. highways. But that has remained constant over the past 25 years, even though the number of vehicles and the number of people traveling has increased 80% since that time. So we have more cars on the road than ever before, but we have about the same number of people dying every year. Now, could NHTSA put even more regulations into place and say, hey, 40,000 is intolerable? But there's an implicit or tacit acceptance of that 40,000 number per year. It may be horrid to actually state that out loud, but from a policy perspective, somewhere in the back of our minds, we're saying, okay, you know, given that people travel 1.2 trillion miles a year on U.S. highways, maybe 40,000 is acceptable loss number. And that's a horrible thing to say out loud, but at the same time, there's some type of metric we have to go with. When we start looking at the software world, however, the software world is so much more difficult because really insecure software or having it in your system is a lot like having a sexually transmitted disease. Nobody wants to admit to it, which means all the statistics around it, that there's a stigma with getting owned by a hacker. Or, you know, when you look at, there's a World Bank report put out in 2002, and that World Bank report basically said that banks all across the world are getting are being blackmailed by these attackers, because the attackers are saying, hey, if you don't give us this money, we're going to go out and tell others that your banking network isn't secure. And this is a huge problem noted by the World Bank. So that means there's a lot of banks getting owned, but they're not telling anyone about it. Why? Well, they have good reasons not to tell somebody. They're going to lose their top 11 clients. They're going to lose X billion dollars a year if, you know, people migrate away from them because of an insecurity, or because they didn't manage the network, or whatever it happens to be. So there's a certain stigma about getting owned. And, you know, part of that may be their own fault, as you, of course, when you start talking about the politics and parts of sexually transmitted diseases. But there's also, which is different than that analogy, is the fact that certain defects came with the product. It wasn't your fault. You got owned because the manufacturer didn't catch the patch didn't catch the vulnerability in the first place, and you got owned. Even if you were a dedicated patcher, even if you were somebody who was hot into configuration and very competent, if they have a zero-day exploit, you're done for. So when we start talking about the real cost, then we have this issue of underreporting or even overreporting. So the victims are going to underreport and say, oh, no, this wasn't an issue for us. And so our real loss was maybe $100,000, when in fact, maybe their real loss was over $1 million, or worse, they don't even know what their real loss was. Then you have the issue of overreporting. You have law enforcement or even security vendors or people in the security space upping the number, saying, well, no, this thing has got to be, you know, $8 billion a month, or, you know, whatever number they might come out with, in order to either bring more attention to the issue or to get more funding for their particular project, which means we have a significant problem of inflation of numbers and deflation of numbers, which means coming out with the actual value is very difficult. One thing that is very clear, however, and what you brought up in your initial question, is the cost of human life. So we have software embedded into airplanes. We have it embedded into our vehicles. We have it embedded into more and more things that we don't even know that it's there. In fact, your typical engine in a car has over 40 microprocessors. Now, that might not be impressive, but if you think about it, those microprocessors don't work unless there's software in them telling them how to work, which means your car can have more software in it than actually your home computer might. In fact, there's been people who have said that the GM transmission or General Motors cars is something around 30 million lines of code. Now, if you think about it, Windows XP has something around 40 million lines of code. So you've got an operating system basically in your transmission. Now, the only thing that saves you at this point, a couple of things might save you, is one, your transmission isn't networked. That is, it isn't connected to the World Wide Web, which means attackers can't reach from Ukraine and touch your transmission. Whew, that's a good thing.
Today.
Yeah. But once it gets networked or OnStar gets connected to the internet, or there's a breach in their firewall that they don't know about it, well, then it gets a little bit more. Maybe we get into the realm of hyperbole. But there's an issue there.
Right.
Now, there's also the issue of the quality of that software. In the case of the 767 that crashed in 1996, the report was the pilots, before they crashed, killing 70 people. They said, well, the computers are just going crazy, and they lost complete orientation and crashed. And the horrible thing about it is that the state representative said, well, this isn't the first time this has happened, which when I first read that really caused me to pause. Like, well, wait, this wasn't the first time to happen? So when software, quote unquote, decides to go crazy, we don't know when that's going to happen. It may be in a 767. It may be in your vehicle. In fact, that's what happened to Prius, the Toyota Prius, in 2006. 23,000 vehicles had to be recalled because a bug in the fuel injector would cause the car to stop working at highway speeds. Basically, you know, you'd be cruising, but you'd have no power, which at a critical juncture could cost you your life. Now, back in the GM had the same experience, however, with one of their trucks, and a 7-year-old boy was killed because the fuel injector failed to operate correctly as the grandfather was pulling into the intersection. Well, that's a critical time to have fuel going to the engine when you're accelerating through an intersection. And as it turns out, the engine didn't get fuel, the car stalled, and a logging truck hit the vehicle. So, you know, that you could say, well, okay, well, Dave, you know, the same thing could happen with any other physical device. That is, what if that fuel injector wasn't run by software? And that argument has merit, I think. Products can fail, okay? But the issue is that no other product has had such a high number of defects. No other product has been injected to so many other products and have so many defects, and yet we seem not to blink twice when that stuff fails. So this brings us back to the issue of the consumer protection and what that cost is on society. When we start looking at consumer spending, we're actually seeing that people are doing less online banking. They're doing less online purchasing because they are no longer trusting the software or no longer trusting the network. They don't know quite what not to trust, and that's really devastating to commerce. So the real cost is still up for debate, but it's a debate that needs to be had.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in for episodes 2 and 3 of this podcast.